1888. I thought it maybe belonged to a sloth, but the fingers are splayed. It's like the hand of a Dr. Seuss character. Amy really is the best gift giver. It's beautiful, I told her. Every time I look at it, I'll think of our paw. She gave it to me at the going-away party. It was held at the Quinn's, and when vegetarian Janet saw it, she flew off the handle. How dare I bring this into her house? Did I have any idea what this animal had gone through, etc.? She put a sort of curse on me. This morning, she left to attend massage school. August 17th. I passed a fight on Broadway near Belmont tonight, a chubby white guy and a black kid who was maybe 15. The white guy seemed a little crazy, and I got the idea that the kid and his friends had provoked him into being just that much crazier. At one point he screamed, "Go back to Nigger Town, nigger!" The black kid took off his belt and charged, swinging it above his head, but the white guy just grabbed it. The two friends, meanwhile, hung back and laughed. August 28th, Raleigh. Dad, Paul, and I spent 18 hours in the front seat of a Toyota pickup truck. 18 hours through Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, Tennessee, and North Carolina. At one point, I fell asleep. Paul reached into my dop kit then, got out my shaving cream, and covered a good 3/4 of my face before I woke up. Later, he elbowed me in the ribs while I was pouring coffee. It went from my thermos to my bare legs and burned me. If I tried to read a magazine, he'd take the page and crumple it up. He dumped a cup of water over my head. He grabbed the skin beneath my arm and twisted it until I begged for mercy. The three of us were crowded together, side by side. It was hot, but I never lost my temper. It was all funny to me, and I laughed while Dad drove, and we all three listened to the radio. August 30th. I told Melina, my parents' Great Dane, that we were going to have her put to sleep on Saturday, and Dad got super angry, as if she could understand me. So I said to her, "Okay, we'll wait until Monday." This made him even angrier, and he ordered me to leave his house. Yesterday I told him I'd ridden my bike to the grocery store and bought a chicken. "No, you didn't," he said. The chicken was right there on the counter, along with the receipt, but still he insisted for absolutely no reason that I hadn't bought it. He refuses to be wrong. August 31st. I would rather be a Klansman in a robe of snowy white than to be a Catholic priest in a robe as black as night, for a Klansman is American. America's his home, but a priest owes his allegiance to a Dago Pope in Rome. That's a 1925 Klan song verse in the Jean Stafford biography I'm reading. Like many good biography subjects, she became a mess toward the end of her life. One of her last ideas was for a recipe book called How to Cook for One While Drunk. September 7th, Emerald Isle. Mom left the beach a day early. Paul drove her. She seems to be in poor health lately. She coughs and hacks a lot more than usual. "The sound of it brings out the worst in me," said the guy with the cigarette in his mouth. "It's bad, though. We call her Mount Vesuvius. She spent a lot of time indoors on this trip." September 19th, Raleigh. A joke, Dean told me. Question. What is it in the air in San Francisco that keeps women from getting pregnant? Answer. Men's legs. September 25th. Last night, Dad predicted that 6 months from now, I will regret having left Chicago. He's been a real terror lately. An hour later, he yelled at me for picking up a meatball with my fingers. It was on a dish in the refrigerator, and he accused me of touching a lot of them before deciding on the largest. I think he worries that I'm spreading AIDS. He doesn't like me drinking out of anyone else's glass, either. Dad doesn't pay attention when you talk to him, so Paul's taken to throwing the term IRS into his sentences. Then it's suddenly, "Hold on a second, what did you say?" October 2nd. I'm in the breakfast nook, drinking a cup of coffee, when, out of nowhere, Dad wants to talk. "I have something important I need to discuss." Then he decides that he has to take Melina for a walk. 10 minutes later, he returns and slams a coaster on the table, which is made of formica, not wood, and anyway, I have my cup on one of the 10 catalogs that arrive in the mailbox every morning. Then we go to the AMP, and the entire time we're in the car, he talks to the dog instead of me. As we walk into the store, he confides that his biggest regret is that Melina never got to have sex, that he ruined all that by getting her spayed. At the AMP, he walks around eating things, free samples, pieces of fruit he should be paying for, whatever's open. He charges into the back room, demanding the freshest tomatoes and discounts on wilted lettuce. He berates the cashiers and bag boys. On the way home, he finally gets to what he'd wanted to talk about, Paul. "That guy is going nowhere fast," he says. He predicts that he'll become an aimless alcoholic, and I remind him that Paul is only 22 and deserves to live a young person's life. Ah, baloney. October 5th, New York. Before leaving for the train station, Mom and I watched part of a Today Show segment about monkeys that are trained as helpers for handicapped people. They showed a quadriplegic fellow in an electric wheelchair instructing his little servant, Lisa, to pick a cassette tape off the floor. The monkey did as she was told, and when the guy ordered Lisa to put it in the machine and press play, she did that as well. Sometimes, to demonstrate their love, the monkeys will stick their filthy hands into the mouths of their masters, who are completely paralyzed and can't swat them away. When the time came, Mom drove me to the station. The train was there, waiting, and when we said goodbye, her eyes welled with tears. I had a terrific time with her this past month. I sure do love my mother. And now I am in New York City. The train took 11 hours, and during that time I accidentally walked in on 3 people who were sitting on the toilet, 2 women and 1 man. Once every hour I'd go to the bar car for a cigarette and listen to the drunks who were always saying something like, "When I say you're a friend, you're a motherfucking friend. I'm not bullshitting you, man." I took a cab from Penn Station, and Rusty was waiting at the apartment when I arrived. It's much bigger than I'd imagined. The neighborhood is too beautiful for me. I don't deserve it. Or, okay, my block I deserve. It's more industrial than the ones around it, and we look out at a parking lot for trucks. 2 short blocks away, though, it's perfect. Tree-lined, winding streets, restaurants and coffee shops, it's enchanting. I can't picture myself in any of those places, but still, how did I get to live here? Rusty says that some of the apartments in this area are going for $1 million. I'm not sure about that, but I do know that a ginger ale costs $3. $3. At 2:30 a.m., Rusty took me out on his motorcycle, and we went all over. At 6:30, I went to bed, and 3 hours later, I got up. First, I hired a siren, then trucks, then car horns, then every noise in the world. I can't get over it. I walk down the street, and I can't get over it. This morning, I went to the nearest supermarket. Chicken was 89 cents a pound. Other things, Wesson oil, orange juice, butter, were generally 15 cents more than they should be. October 7th. Everywhere I go in New York, people are selling electrical tape. They sell it in stores, on the sidewalk, on card tables, and at street fairs. There must be a terrific demand for it here. On Rusty's TV, on a cable channel, I saw a nude woman say, "I want to wipe my pussy with your face, motherfucker." On TV. At last night's feature gallery opening, I heard someone whisper, "Is she the one who sets herself on fire?" I saw lots of chicken today for $1.50 a pound. October 11th. Today I saw a woman with no legs who said, "Can you give me $1, sweetheart? I'm trying to buy an electric wheelchair." I think beer is expensive here. A 6-pack of Bud, for instance, is $6 for Bud. So tonight I'm drinking Schmitz for $2.89. Lily told me that an ounce of pot goes anywhere from $320 to $400. I felt bad in Chicago paying $60 for a quarter. I haven't worked out my coffee situation yet. Each night I try somewhere different. Chock Full of Nuts has too many distractions, so The best place so far is the Bagel Buffet on 6th Avenue. The IHOP gives customers a whole pot. It's awful coffee, but at least you don't have to flag someone down every 10 minutes. Plus, you could sit in a booth for as long as you needed to, and they never hustled you out. At the Bagel Buffet, you get a paper cup of coffee for 60 cents, so it's just $1.80 for 3 cups, which I can afford if I cut back a little in other places. Now, I need a library card. October 14th. Tonight on 6th Avenue, I saw a completely naked woman. She was black, disturbed, and her breasts hung down to her waist. I saw her yesterday in the same spot, but dressed and yelling, "I'm getting drunk!" I previously enjoyed walking down 6th, but tonight it was rowdy and humid, and someone threw a bottle that smashed on the sidewalk 10 feet away from me. Who threw it? The nice thing about crowds is that someone can throw a bottle and you don't take it personally. I saw 2 more people without feet today, one before and one after I walked to the Central Park Zoo. It's not nearly as big as the one in Lincoln Park in Chicago, or as well stocked. For example, they have ants at the Central Park Zoo. From watching the original Cat People movie, I was expecting panthers, but the wildest things they had were polar bears. Then there were penguins, monkeys, bats, and tortoises, which really made time when the guy showed up with their food. It was funny to see them run, their necks stretched out, their eyes bulging. At a store called Gay Treasures on Hudson Street, I heard a man in his mid-50s talk to the cashier, who was around the same age, about his new boyfriend. "He spanks me raw at least twice a week. Last night, he used an umbrella." "He should have stuck it up your ass," the cashier said. The customer leaned forward. "Who said he didn't?" October 15th. I screwed up my courage this afternoon and called Philip Morris. Rusty then told me that I wanted William Morris. They're the talent agency. Philip Morris is the cigarette company. I walked around today and saw a man get chased and kicked in the ass for taking an apple from a fruit stand. Tonight it's cool and the air is dry. The city smells like burnt coffee. October 19th. Lily has been painting and doing light carpentry work in the townhouse of an antiques dealer. He has a little dog named Crumpet that acts pitiful and lame when it wants food and attention. She told me about him at a falafel restaurant in the East Village, and then I told her about my downstairs neighbors who have been complaining about the sound of my footsteps. "Because of them, I now go barefoot when I'm at home," I told her, "and I tiptoe." A woman sitting near us finished her meal and said to me on her way out, "Listen, you pay rent too. There's no need for you to tiptoe around your own apartment." October 21st. Every day I get the paper from the same trash can on Abingdon Square and look through the want ads. Tomorrow at 9 I'm applying at UPS. Then Lily is paying me $20 to help her carry a ladder. So for days I can feel resourceful. I hope that UPS hires me, even if it means I have to work through Christmas. I want a job so I can buy things. October 22nd. I went to 43rd and 11th to apply for a driver's helper job at UPS. It was maybe 10 o'clock when I arrived, and there were a good 300 people in line ahead of me. Many of them were dressed in suits. Others looked like they had just been passing by and saw the sign. While waiting for my interview, I listened to the 2 men in front of me. One said that his wife had just had a baby and that he'd lost his job because a friend had borrowed his driver's license and had a wreck. "So it went on my record," he said. You can't tell that story to a potential employer. They don't want a guy with crummy friends who ask you to do things like loan them your license. The UPS interviews were conducted by 10 people, some of them, a Japanese man, a black woman, talked to applicants for a long time and wound up scheduling callbacks. I got stuck with a white guy, Mr. Hardball, who did not even shake my hand. At 5, I met with Lily, who paid me to help her carry a ladder. We picked it up on Canal Street at the loft of a guy named Hugh and his 2 roommates, Scott and Leslie. Their place was spacious and homey, like a log cabin. Hugh had a wet bar in the shape of a tree stump. Leslie was making an apple pie, and they were listening to All Things Considered. Hugh was handsome, a nice guy, gay. Lily and I walked the ladder to a studio apartment on the corner of Jane and Greenwich, and she gave me $20. For the first time since arriving in New York, I feel like I've plugged a leak. October 24th. Macy's Herald Square, the largest store in the world, has big opportunities for outgoing, fun-loving people of all shapes and sizes who want more than just a holiday job. Working as an elf in Macy's Santaland means being at the center of the excitement. So I called, and I have an interview next Wednesday at 11 o'clock. October 25th. Lily and I saw a dead man on West 11th. He had jumped from a sixth-floor window, landed on a car, and rolled into the street, where he was lying in an ever-expanding pool of blood. You could see that on the way down he'd hit a tree. I wondered if, at the last minute, he changed his mind and tried to grab hold of the branches, many of which were broken now. A crowd formed, and some boys who'd seen him jump claimed to have heard his skull crack. People passing said, "What happened?" And the two kids, celebrities now, acted as spokesmen. Tonight I paid $5 to watch an Irish performance artist at Margot's Gallery. It's the money that kills me, because this was just the worst. It's like she followed a formula. 1, show slides. 2, arrange your various props on the floor. 3, use them one by one. 4, don't say a word. 5, incorporate blood. It was insufferable. The props included a mannequin's head, feathers, a mound of soil, a shovel, a bell, a few vials. After arranging them just so, she used them, one after another, for an hour. If you're going to perform wordlessly, you need to wow people with your movement, or your music, or lighting. But she was not graceful or clever or well-prepared. She rolled herself in paper, she fell to the ground. I was so relieved when it ended that I applauded, a mistake, as I don't think things like this should be encouraged. October 28th. On Friday night, I met Lily on Jane Street, and we carried the ladder back to Hugh's place on Canal. I was excited to be there, and decided to have a crush on him. We sat for a while, drank a beer. Scott and Leslie had put up a bird feeder, which was fine until the birds got sloppy with the seeds and rats showed up. I wanted to stay but had to leave to meet Gretchen, who'd arrived from Providence and needed to be picked up at her friend's place on 103rd Street. October 31st. This afternoon I sat in the 8th floor Santaland office at Macy's and was told, "Congratulations, Mr. Sedaris, you are an elf." I return tomorrow at 9:30 for my training schedule, but in the meantime, me and the others who were hired were shown a chart from last year. A third of the names had stars beside them. Those, we learned, were elves Santa had invited back for a second or third year. A woman named Marianne told us she'd had more than her fair share of bad elves. There are various ways of being categorized as bad. Parents can get cranky, Marianne said. Children can get cranky, but an elf cannot get cranky. November 14th. Everyone on Earth knows I'm an elf. Everyone. Today I went to Feature and met a woman who was talking to Jim and Hudson. I looked around at the show then and heard her quietly ask, "Is the little elf still here?" Hudson gave me flyers for the reading next week. It starts at 8:30, but I'm supposed to be there by 7:45. I have elf training until 6 that day, so I will need to have my clothes laid out. November 20th. I read last night at the kitchen. There were around 80 people there. Hugh came, and Lily. The audience took things pretty seriously, which was disappointing. I was hoping for laughs. November 23rd. This was the official opening day of Santaland, and I worked for 8 hours. I started the morning at the magic window, then spent time as an exit elf, Santa elf, maze elf, and counter elf. The Santas wear wool suits. They sweat and get heat rashes on their asses and knees. Most of them sit on pillows. I get an hour for lunch and a 20-minute afternoon break. Today I ate in the cafeteria with a she-elf whose husband is a female impersonator. November 25th. I was a photo elf yesterday when two men, both in their mid-20s, came to visit Santa. They didn't want to sit on his lap or have their pictures taken. Instead, they just wanted to be sensitive. When asked what they wanted for Christmas, one of them said, "I'd like it if some homeless people could have a decent meal." His friend nodded in agreement. "Right on." I stopped listening and fooled around with some stuffed animals on the mantle. When I turned back around, the men were on their way out the door. "And hey, Santa," one of them said, "look after our boys in the Gulf, will you?" He said it with such gooey poignancy. Santa and I laughed merrily after they'd left. The elf I share a locker with, Keith, invited me to his Bible study group tomorrow night. December 7th. Lily and I saw a warning poster outside a small theater that read, "This play will leave you feeling sad and empty." I led a 5-year-old boy to Santa's door and said, "Look at all the toys my master has." The kid was small but sophisticated. "I've got more toys than that. To tell you the truth, I'm very spoiled." I got yelled at twice today. Once, when I was working as an entrance elf. The job amounts to hustling up visitors, and I thought I did a pretty good job. "Patronize Santa," I said. "Behold his chubby majesty. Santa was born and raised in a small home. Hail him. Santa's patience is beyond your comprehension. Come test it." I'd been at it for 10 minutes when the manager came by. Then he went and rounded up two other managers, and the three of them brought me to the desk for a scolding. I wasn't saying anything nasty or sexual, though. I just heightened the discourse a little. December 10th. Walking home, I passed two men on 14th Street who were working with long poles, one of which hit me in the nose and drew blood. The man who hit me found it funny and laughed. "Hey," I said, "that really hurt." He laughed all the harder, and I asked if I could hit him on the nose with a long pole so we could be even. I told him he had to apologize, so he did, but it doesn't really count because I had to ask for it. Today, a Japanese child came and played his violin for Santa. December 29th, Raleigh. Tell people you live in New York, and I've noticed they'll offer a half dozen reasons why they don't live there. The crowds, the high cost of living, the crime. I'm not suggesting they move or anything. Far from it. It's funny how defensive certain people get. January 2nd, New York. I took the Cary bus from LaGuardia and was crossing 42nd Street when a guy said, "Hey, big man, how about giving me one of those cigarettes?" He was a good 6 inches taller than me, so I pointed that out and asked why he'd called me big man. "Did you think I'd find it flattering?" "Hey," he said, "that's just the way I am." I said, "Fine, and this is the way I am." As I walked away, he called out after me, "Hey, it's just a fucking cigarette." "Well, you know me," I called back. In front of Grand Central, a big black guy asked did I want a taxi, and when I said yes, he grabbed my duffel bag and proceeded down the street. I followed and watched as he hailed a cab, threw my bag into the back seat, and demanded a tip. I took my bag out of the back seat and hailed another cab. The driver told me that he hates those self-appointed porters. When he hears one of them shake a passenger down for a tip, he rolls down his window and shouts, "You don't owe him shit. Don't give him nothing." January 7th. I found a Play Guy magazine in a trash can on West 4th Street and read the letters section, where a college student wrote that 6 months ago he began drinking his own semen. The kinkiest thing I ever did was the time I saved up a 7-day output of my cum and put it in a bottle. I went to the cafeteria for dinner, got a salad, pulled my little bottle out of my pocket and put it on the table. When a couple of PE majors asked what it was, I told them that it was high-protein salad dressing my mom had sent me. Several of them asked to share my dressing, which I gladly did. I could barely contain myself as I watched these guys pour my cum on their greens and eat it. Now, some people might think my antics are a bit much, but I enjoy it, and it feels good. Isn't that what sex is all about? I enjoy it, and it feels good. Doesn't really justify his actions, in my opinion. Then again, he can't honestly have done this, can he? February 5th. Elaine called last night with a possible job. I'd be working for an Italian woman named Alba, who runs a small press and is looking for a personal assistant 2 days a week for $10 an hour. I think it involves typing, which might be a problem. On the phone, she was enthusiastic, so we'll see. February 7th. This afternoon, I met with Alba at the Chelsea Hotel, where she rents a room she uses as an office. She's a trim woman, pretty, nice clothes, nice accent. When I arrived, she was talking to another trim and beautiful woman, an American, who was planning to attend a 24-hour chanting seminar led by a noted Buddhist. She said she really, really needed to chant and throw out some good energy, that the world would be a better place for it. After the American woman left, I looked at a book Alba and her business partner had recently published. I remarked that it was beautifully bound and printed, and Alba sighed, saying, "I am tired now of beauty." My understanding is that the press is more or less a hobby for her. There are parts she enjoys and parts she avoids. I would take care of what she avoids. I admitted that I type with only one finger and have never in my life touched a computer. The last person who worked for her was paid $10 an hour. She offered me $7. I said it wasn't enough, and she told me she'd be talking to some other people. John Smith is in town, and last night we went to the Tunnel Bar. Just before leaving, I stepped in to use the bathroom, which is just one toilet in a room. There is a sink as well, and standing beside it was a fellow I'd seen earlier. He asked my name, and then said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Dave. Do you like having your toes sucked?" I wanted to say, "That's David. Nobody calls me Dave." But I was so shocked by his question I couldn't do anything but look down at my feet. "I was watching you in the other room, Dave, and stepped in here hoping we could talk. Now, here we are, talking." I turned to leave, and he put his foot in front of the door, blocking it. "Just hear me out, Dave, because I think you're really going to like what I have to say. What size shoes are those you're wearing?" I told him they were a 7.5, and that my feet are perfectly flat. "Good," he said. "Small, flat feet equals big cock." That's the most ridiculous equation I've ever heard, I thought. "I bet you've got a very veiny cock, don't you, Dave?" "No more than anyone else," I said. "I mean, I don't know. I never thought about it. It's got a lot of blue veins, doesn't it, Dave?" Let's just say that it does, okay, Dave?" He told me that he was going to take my shoes off and start by sucking my toes, slowly, and that his upper teeth would tap just slightly against my nails, not biting, mind you. "We don't even know each other," I argued. "Besides, I'm here with a friend visiting from out of town." "No problem," he said. "I'll do everything to him that I plan to do to you." He wouldn't unblock the door until I promised to take it up with John, who was standing out front waiting for me, and who said, "What took you so long?" when I finally found him. February 11th. I took part in 3 orchid shows at PS 122. They were all sold out, and the audiences were kind and responsive. On Friday, Andy from One Life to Live was in the audience. She plays Max Holden's sister and gave me her autograph, which read, "To David, you were wonderful. Please write for our show." I can't believe it. A number of bookers for clubs were there, and the head of PS 122 invited me back. Then there were guys, most of whom were dandelions. That's my name for men with short hair dyed yellow. They almost always have two pierced ears and wear leather jackets. The uniform makes them unappealing to me. That's what's good about Hugh. He's his own person, looks-wise. After last night's event, I came home and found $350 worth of traveler's checks I'd never cashed. I was paid $100 per night for the show, so if I budget, I can pay rent and last at least a short while longer. February 24th. Today the United States began its ground war in Kuwait. Saddam Hussein said the American troops would drown in their own blood, but they met no opposition and took 5,000 prisoners. It's strange to see the war from New York. I've noticed a surprising number of yellow ribbons and posters of American flags with the words, "These colors don't run," printed beneath them. Then, too, you hear, "No blood for oil," a lot. March 3rd. I have to get these sculptures off to the Renaissance Society, and I asked Hugh over to take a look and advise me on finishes. He is very handsome, a hard worker, thoughtful. His dad was a diplomat, so the family left Kentucky when he was a kid and lived in Ethiopia and Somalia and the Congo. He lived in Paris for 5 years after graduating from college and is here now, painting. Hugh looked at the sculptures and said, "Just oil them." Then we joined Lily, Hugh's roommates, and another couple at a place in Little Italy. Someone or other knew the bartender who charged us $20 for $150 worth of drinks. Hugh and I flirted all night. Is that the right word? I drank out of his glass and got him to say that he hated me, which usually means the opposite. At the end of the night, he said he'd call me later this week. Then he left with Scott and Leslie. I left with Lily in the opposite direction, and when I turned around to look at him, I saw that he'd turned around as well. It was romantic. March 15th. The Village Voice came out with me in the Choices section. North Carolina transplant David Sedaris reads his wry, hilarious stories and diaries, withering social comedy, leavened by an emphatic eye for the soulful ridiculousness of our behavior. I'll never know why they chose me, but still it's nice. I got the name of the guy who wrote it and have already sent him a thank you letter. March 16th. I'm down to $190 and I'm starting to panic. In this situation, I have no business buying pot, but that's what I did. Scotch, too. March 19th. I worked today for Alba. The person she hired instead of me didn't pan out, so she called this morning, and I was at the Chelsea Hotel by noon. She'd planned for us to spend the day going through the files, but then Cy Twombly invited her to lunch, so I was here on my own. I went through the papers she wanted me to go through and filled out a quarterly tax form. I've never in my life done anything remotely close to that. In the end, I called an accountant twice. Then I phoned the New York State Tax Board and asked them what was 8.25% of $25. The woman said, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but we can't tell you that." Eventually, Alba returned from lunch. We were supposed to bring boxes to the house she had just bought, a whole house on Bleecker Street, but then Herbert Hunky came to visit. I understand that he's famous, but I've never read any of his writing. The guy is old and in poor health. He spoke slowly and told a dull story. Then a young guy came by, and I didn't much care for him. He dropped a lot of names and seemed annoyed that I didn't already know who he was. March 21st. On this, the first day of spring, I am able to shop around and find chicken for 59 cents per pound, coffee for $2.99 a pound, and spaghetti on sale, 2 boxes, for $1. Tonight I'll have chicken with some squid ink linguine Hugh brought me. It's black. This spring I am, if I am not mistaken, in love. I started working for a Kentucky man named Jeffrey Lee, who was painting a master bedroom at 77th and 5th. I saw splendors today, things I had no idea existed. This apartment is vast, 10 rooms, maybe more, huge rooms with fireplaces and windows looking onto Central Park. The owners are a couple in their mid-40s who have no children. They've built a special bathroom for their dogs with a floor that flushes. The two came in this afternoon with their decorator, who lives not far away, in Klaus von Bülow's old apartment. We went over at the end of the day, and I couldn't believe my eyes. In the living room, or whatever you call the room next to the living room, she had a door-sized sergeant painting, just hanging there. Jeffrey Lee wears a big beret and smokes Lucky Strikes and has anxiety attacks. His brother died of AIDS, and now he has it too. I asked how he controls his fear of dying, and he said drugs, prescribed drugs, and Jack Daniels. March 26th. I waited for Alba for 40 minutes this morning, standing outside her door at the Chelsea. She arrived wearing a tailored suit and worrying that it made her look frumpy. In the end, she changed, then did different things with her hair. Alba can't wait in line at a restaurant or the post office. She doesn't have that kind of time. I worked for a few hours, and then she borrowed $50 from the guy at the front desk, and we went to an Italian place called Intermezzo that had a $4 lunch special. I paid for my own meal, fine, but I also didn't charge her for the time I spent waiting, and this when I'm getting $3 an hour less than the last person who did my job. I wouldn't mind, but I'm broke right now, and could have made a lot more money working for Jeffrey Lee today. I have to do something about my finances. I don't want Hugh to think I'm shiftless, and I don't want to scare him away by relying on him. I've always counted on things to work out, and they usually do, but the stakes are higher here. I'm surrounded by people who have more money than they know what to do with, and none of them have earned it. March 27th. I received an offer for the Citibank City Card, which promises me instant cash privileges if I need to spend time in a hospital. If I lose both hands and feet, I am entitled to $20,000 under their cash benefits for accidental dismemberment clause. If I lose one hand or one foot, I get half that. But if I lose one hand and one foot, I'm back up to $20,000. April 3rd. Jeffrey Lee says, ish, a lot. How do the curtains look? Ish. He can pay me $200 on Friday so I can pay Rusty the rest of the rent money I owe him. So far with Jeffrey Lee, I've earned maybe $650. I've earned another $100 with Alba and have $80 in the bank, so I'll be rich. Ish. April 9th. Last night I read at the Knot Room. The opening act was a singing duo, the guy on ukulele and the woman on violin. Their first song was called Everyone Here is White Tonight. When they finished, 8 people left. That happens all the time. People leave after their friends are done. After the exodus, there were maybe 20 audience members left, but it's a tiny room, so it didn't feel empty. Alba came, which was sweet of her. April 13th. I work today for David Donner, a marketing analyst who paints apartments on the side. He's been hired to do a one-bedroom on 29th and Lexington, and I'm helping him for $11 an hour. We met on the sidewalk outside the building this morning because the doormen were giving him such a hard time. They're the worst, these guys. They take loads of shit from the tenants, and then they heap it on whoever's less powerful. The service elevator operators are just as bad. They say we're not allowed to work on the weekends, and that if they knock on the door and find us painting, they'll cut off the electricity. He's tireless, David. 5 minutes for lunch. His regular assistant is on vacation. I asked what he was like, and David used the term workhorse 3 times. At first he was very terse, but he loosened up as the day went on and told me that his dad is a veterinarian. You'd think that would spell pets, but his mother didn't want animals walking through the rooms of their house unescorted, so they had none. We worked 8 hours, and he paid me in cash at the end of the day. April 18th. Alba spent the better part of the day crying. I asked what was wrong, and she said, "Everything." I felt bad for her. April 21st. I worked with David Donner again today, which is Sunday. The doormen were on strike, so they brooded outside the building as opposed to inside the building. In their place are private security guards who issued David and me passes we need in order to exit and re-enter. I went out at 1 to buy lunch and was in the lobby when one of the striking doormen stepped in and called me Buster, as in, "You're going to have to clean up those footprints, Buster." He pointed to something I could barely see. So I said, "All right, can you give me something to clean them with?" He told me to go upstairs and get something. "Would you make a mess like that in your own home?" he asked. And again, I could barely see what he was talking about. And wasn't he supposed to be outside on strike? "I'm a very clean person," I told him. He said, "I'll have you thrown out of here and make sure you never come back. I'll take that goddamn car to yours and tear it to pieces. You hear me, Buster?" People in the lobby turned to see what the fuss was. "God damn you, you're out of here," the doorman said. I went upstairs and returned with a damp rag. Then I got on my hands and knees and cleaned my faint footprints off the carpet. Boy, my blood was boiling. It was pouring when I went out for lunch. On my way back in, the security guard asked to see my pass, which was complete bullshit, as 5 minutes earlier he'd seen me crawl in front of him on my hands and knees. So I had lunch in one hand, an umbrella in the other, and as I searched my pockets for my pass, I got yelled at for dripping water onto the carpet. I don't know where to begin with these assholes. I really don't. April 25th. Today we moved the office from the Chelsea Hotel to Alba's house on Bleecker Street, 4 full floors and 2 basements. She hired movers, 2 nice Colombians who have a company called Going. I don't think Alba understands the thoughts of people who are working. If you've carried a big TV up 4 flights of stairs, you don't want a lot of hemming and hawing about where it goes. You just want to set it down. At one point, I suggested that if she was going from the 1st to the 3rd floor, it wouldn't hurt her to carry a little something up, a magazine, maybe, or a coffee cup. She told me that she was not a lazy person, and then she went up empty-handed. Later, she had a fit when one of the floor refinishers broke a mirror. It was the type you'd put on the back of a closet door, nothing valuable or hard to replace, but still she went bananas, throwing her purse against the wall, throwing down the book she was holding. "Fucking fuckers," she shouted. "How dare you do this to me? You broke that mirror. It's my first day in this house, and now I am stuck with the fucking bad luck you have made." "I thought you told us you didn't want this mirror," one of the guys said. Alba yelled that that wasn't the point. "It's here, and it's broken, and now I have to suffer." When he reminded her that she didn't break it, and that perhaps the bad luck wasn't hers, she got even angrier. It was an amazing tantrum. May 16th. Alba dictated a letter today, which, when typed up, made no sense whatsoever. I don't understand how someone can use the word contemporary twice in one sentence that runs for 9 lines and then get upset because I misspelled completely. June 22nd. After Bonnie and Clyde were gunned down, souvenir hunters mobbed the car, taking with them shards of windshield glass, upholstery, and even hanks of human hair. One fellow was caught attempting to saw off Clyde Barrow's ear. I read that somewhere yesterday. June 25th. Tiffany was hit by a car this weekend while riding her bike. This is the second time it's happened, and again she went to the hospital. There's no great damage, she just scraped up is all. Now she's planning to sue, and has hired herself a shyster lawyer. He told her to make 20 visits to a chiropractor he frequently works with, and says he'll aim for a $5,000 settlement, of which he'll retain a third. It seems she'll spend her share on the appointments, won't she? Plus, the lawyer told her to take a week off from her job, and that's another financial setback. Tiffany never mentioned a thing about it. It was Mom who told me. She's furious. June 26th. I began a writing class at the Y tonight, and though the teacher hasn't a knack for generating critical discussion, I still get a kick out of her. At one point, she read a poem by someone I'm not familiar with. History has borne him out to be something of an anti-Semite and a racist, but he was funny, she said. Our homework assignment is to write a story in the form of a diary entry. June 27th. In addition to the house on Bleecker Street, Alba has two apartments on 7th between C and D, one in the basement and another on the ground floor. I emptied out the former this afternoon with the help of a mover named Patrick, who drives the big van and wears plastic-framed glasses. It must be hard having someone who never lifts a finger telling you all day to be careful to not scratch the walls or drop something, etc., but he was good at tuning it out. Patrick is maybe 5 years older than me. He lives in Chelsea and pays $650 for 3 rooms. At the end of the day, I gave him my number and told him to call me if he ever needs any help. It turns out he can use me on Saturday morning and will pay me $10 an hour. June 29th. I worked today hard for Patrick, the mover. It was a 13-hour shift, and I left with bruises on my thighs. It reached 97 degrees this afternoon, and at times I could wring water from my shirt. That said, between the payment and the tips, I made $155. I also drank 7 Gatorades. Our first job was a double, 2 people moving to 2 different places. One of them had packed in plastic bags, while the other had used huge boxes, which is always a mistake, especially when you're moving into a 6th-floor walk-up. Joining Patrick and me today was a guy named Willie, who lives with his parents in Queens and was once thrown into prison in Argentina. As for the people we moved, it was amazing to watch them walk up the stairs of their old and new apartments completely empty-handed. What was great was driving all over town, Harlem, the Upper West Side, Chelsea, the Village. Patrick says, "Let's ride." At one point, we went to his apartment on 16th Street, which was really dirty and messy. On our way back to the van, he told me that Alba had not tipped him. Even worse, after we'd unloaded all her stuff at the house on Bleecker, she tried to talk him down on the previously agreed-upon price. She's leaving for Provincetown tomorrow, so no work this week. July 10th. My writing class is held at the Y on 63rd Street. One Life to Live is filmed just 3 blocks away. And tonight, while passing the studio, I saw the actor who plays Max Holden talking to 2 fans. After commenting on the stories we turned in last week, our teacher advised us to throw all taste and decency out the window and use lots of violence in our next assignment. Walking home, I fell in behind 2 black women, 1 short and 1 tall. Some little bitch kept phoning the short woman's house, and she'd had it. "When I get mad, I don't argue," she said. "I swing." July 15th. Hugh and I were on the subway when 2 women boarded. One was obese, and she pointed to the far end of the car saying, "Oh, look, Dorothy, 2 seats together." The 2 of them walked over, and then the heavy woman sat down, filling both the seats. August 1st. I worked for Alba again today. She's preparing to leave 7th Street and is kindly giving the basement apartment to the writer, Herbert Hunky, and his 21-year-old protege, Jason. I asked the kid where the 2 of them met, and he said, "At the methadone clinic." In our past encounters, Herbert was almost grotesquely polite. He's a charmer, always begging and borrowing money for drugs. He'd hoped to move into the apartment tomorrow and complained that it wasn't in the state he'd been promised it would be in. So that was my job today, to paint it. Shitty latex on shitty, unprepared walls. Herbert wanted the floors done in black enamel, but Alba had already bought white and didn't feel like exchanging it. This put Herbert in a foul mood that soured as the afternoon progressed. The place needed to be finished by tonight, and at 7, Alba asked the 2 men to help. Jason suddenly remembered an appointment he was late for, and Herbert angrily dunked the latex paint roller into the enamel. The roller was ruined by that point, so we started painting the floor, a dumb thing to do when the walls weren't finished. When I mentioned this, he turned on me saying, "What do you know, office boy?" Office boy? Me? He doesn't know how to work a roller, and I'm the know-nothing? Herbert had a tantrum. Then he asked for turpentine. Terps, he called it. And I told him we didn't have any. "Then how do you expect to wash your hands?" I told him I planned never to wash my hands again, and he stormed off and sat in the front window. There he crabbed at the people who passed by. He yelled at a guy who touched the sewing machine Alba had left on the curb, hoping someone might take it. He yelled at a neighbor whose gate squeaked, "You ought to oil that damn thing." "You ought to oil your fucking head," the man shouted back, apparently unaware that he was talking to a very important petty thief and heroin addict. August 4th. The day before yesterday, Patrick and I moved a humorless waiter from 171st Street to 110th. The guy said he'd had both Milton Berle and John Gotti as customers, and that the latter had left him no tip. We didn't like the waiter, but he was much better than Lola and Raoul, the idiotic club kids we moved last night. She's from Nigeria, he's from Israel, and between the two of them, they hadn't a single box. Who moves without boxes? They had vases of flowers, plates, all the things you'd find in an apartment, just sitting there. Unbelievable. Lola was very beautiful, and must have had money in order to afford all the expensive clothing I handled. She had a little lapdog named Poochie that yapped nonstop. The entire job was a nightmare. I'd carry something to the truck, and she'd say, "No, not that lamp. Take it back upstairs." And Raoul was just as bad, all, "Come here now, and you must listen to me." August 20th. Before moving people, I talked to Tiffany. Then Mom called to say that Lisa and Bob's wedding will take place in a dry county. Bob's parents don't approve of cigarettes, so she said we'll have to drink and smoke in our hotel rooms. September 20th. Amy is in town to do our play, so we were together last night when Mom called and told us that she has lung cancer. She phoned from the hospital, her voice stuffy sounding due to a tube she had in her nose. We are all of us shocked. The surprise isn't that it's lung cancer over any other type, but that she has it at all. It made sense that Mrs. Steigerwald, Mrs. Rury, and Uncle Dick had cancer. Not that they were deserving of it, but you could picture them in waiting rooms. I always felt certain we weren't that kind of people. It's silly, but that's what I'd told myself. The tumor is lemon-sized, but it hasn't spread, which is good. On Monday, the doctors will present a treatment plan, and she'll let us know what it is. After Mom hung up, Amy and I talked to Lisa and Tiffany. Paul doesn't know yet. She hasn't told him. On the phone, she said it very simply, "I have news for you. I have cancer." This is the last day of summer. The temperature was in the low 60s, crisp. Before rehearsal, I went to the new apartment on Thompson Street and watched for a while as Hugh chipped away plaster and exposed the brick wall beneath it. September 24th. Mom called to say they have outlined a course of treatment. Surgery's been suggested, but first they have to make her strong enough to withstand it. They have her exercising, trying to improve her breathing. It's hard to imagine Mom jogging or riding a bike, so for the time being, she's just walking. Meanwhile, she's going through her jewelry, setting aside things for each daughter. She said she's not stepping into her grave, but just managing her time, and that since I don't wear jewelry, she's sending me $1,000. Lately, what with the play, I worry about money until my gums bleed, so it'll come in handy. Next week, Mom and Eleanor are going out wig shopping, which is scary. She told me she's still smoking, but only 4 cigarettes a day. Afterwards, she sprays the bathroom with perfume so Dad won't smell anything. She has a collapsed lung, so it's not a great idea for her to go to the mountains for Lisa's wedding, but still she's determined to make it. I've talked about this with Tiffany and Gretchen, and I don't want any of you smoking at the wedding dinner, not at the table. Bob's people don't like it, so the least you can do is step outside. October 14th. Lisa got married on Saturday afternoon on top of Eagle Nest Mountain. I'd worried it might be sort of hokey, but in fact it was nice to be outdoors, and in such a beautiful place. Lisa wore white, but not a wedding dress. She and Bob stayed someplace nice, and the rest of us were at an Econo Lodge in Waynesville. It was on a highway, but across the road was a pleasant cemetery we could walk to and get high in a circle of stone crosses tall enough to actually crucify people on. This morning, Mom has her first appointment with a radiologist, and tomorrow they're doing a scan of her brain. Wednesday, they're looking at her bones, and she's just taking it as it comes. All weekend, she was sneaking cigarettes, asking for a drag off mine or Gretchen's or Tiffany's. October 15th. All day I had a terrible headache, so I went and had my hair cut at a place on 6th Avenue that I'd passed several times but never entered. The barber was Italian and really took his time. All the magazines I noticed had naked women in them. Playboy, on the soft end, and on the hard side, Pink in Film, which had on the cover a woman wearing a strap-on penis. While I was gone, the play continued. William said that the shows went well, but that the audiences were on the small side, 6 to 8 people per night. October 16th. Amy and I walked up 8th Avenue to Intermezzo, where Hugh and his friend Sue were having lunch. "Here you are," Amy shouted. "Just what do you think you're doing? You can't afford to be eating here, not when I've got a 5-month-old baby waiting in the car. And wine, too? You're drinking wine? I hate being your sponsor. I really do." Everyone stared, and Hugh turned bright red. Afterward, I went to Macy's, where I filled out umpteen forms, peed into a jar, and had my eyes tested. This year, as a returning elf, I'll make $9 an hour. Regular Christmas help only gets 6. October 28th. Last night was the final performance of the play, Jamboree. The house was packed, so we brought in extra chairs. Unfortunately, we brought too many, meaning that, once again, we had empty seats. In the end, the audience numbered 64, which was great, the biggest so far. Afterward, we struck the set and then came home to cook chicken, which we ate at 3:30 in the morning. The night before that, I performed at PS 122 as part of their avant-garde-arama. The house was sold out, and though we were told to limit ourselves to 20 minutes, most people went on much longer, a trio of girls, for instance, who slowly rolled 100 oranges across the floor. I'm having a bad run as far as readings are concerned. I was bad at the Nehorican and bad at PS 122. Next Monday, I'm at La Mama and then Ward Nassi, followed by a benefit, followed by 2 weeks of orchid shows, and then another gallery. I stretch myself too thin and wind up with tiny houses. November 1st. Hugh and I moved into our new apartment last night, but I screwed up and we won't have phone service until the 12th, and that's if we're lucky. I thought they could turn it on from some office somewhere, but instead they have to make a special trip that should have been scheduled weeks ago. I was supposed to do this last month, but I didn't. I fucked up. After paying this month's rent and giving Rusty the money I owed him, I'm left with $40. I might make some at La Mama this week, but without a way for people to call me, I'm screwed. November 3rd. Amy and I met Jeff and Tina for a drink last night at El Teddy's, the fancy Mexican place in Tribeca that sometimes feels exciting and sometimes feels awful. Last night, it was the latter. I was standing in front of a woman who was seated at the bar, waiting on friends, and said to her, "Excuse me," as I reached over and dunked a tortilla chip in salsa. I then put it in my mouth and was chewing away when she said, "Hey, you got tomato stains on my pants." I looked down and watched as she stabbed at the red spots with a wet napkin. She was super angry, like this was the last straw. Her friends weren't showing up, the place was too crowded, and now some idiot had spilled salsa on her new tan slacks. "Oh, gosh," I said, "I'm terribly sorry about your pants." With the letter P, a shard of tortilla chip flew from my mouth right into the corner of her eye. I couldn't believe it. "Jesus fucking Christ," she said, "now you spit on me." She wanted me dead, and it only got worse when her friends showed up. I caught her pointing at me, the creep who ruined her outfit, and then spat on her. November 5th. I talked to Mom this afternoon, called her from Alba's phone. She's lost 6 pounds this week. The chemo and radiation make her nauseated, and she recently finished a meal after going 5 days without one. She checks her comb for hairs that have fallen out, but so far hasn't found any. I'd expected her to be down and depressed, but she was full of good hospital stories.